This is an ABC podcast.
Chinese health authorities are still working to identify the virus behind a pneumonia outbreak in the central city of Wuhan.
This new coronavirus was initially traced to live animals.
The Chinese confirming that it is now spreading from human to human.
Already spreading to Japan and Thailand. Some American airports have begun screening passengers flying from central China for the virus.
In Seattle, the first confirmed U.S. case of the contagious coronavirus.
And in the now city of Wuhan, Washington where the State. Outbreak began, patients now in isolation, all trains and planes out of that city halted just
There's
tonight.
Confirmation the coronavirus has reached Australia.
A travel ban will be placed on all non-residents, non-Australian citizens coming to Australia.
Europe has now become the epicenter of the pandemic.
Europe's open borders are closing.
Stay home or face punishment. The words of French President Emmanuel Macron on Monday as the French government ramped up its lockdown.
47 million people in Spain, they're ordered to stay inside.
Italians are being advised simply to stay at home.
In 2019, only virologists talked about coronaviruses. Now, most of us are all too familiar with them. Nearly 2 years after the first cases of COVID-19 were diagnosed in China, billions of people have now lived under lockdown orders, over 260 million people have had the disease, and more than 5 million people have died from it, a number that is likely a severe undercount. So could the world have avoided this by being better coordinated? I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley. And today on The Signal, even though this pandemic is far from over, diplomats are meeting virtually today and tomorrow to assess how prepared we are for the next one. So what are they considering? And has the world really learnt the lessons of the pandemic?
So my name's Adam Cameron-Scott and I'm the new Professor and Chair of Global Public Health at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy.
So Adam, what do we mean when we talk about a pandemic treaty? What would it be?
Well, this is going to be the big million-dollar question, really, as to whether or not the proposal for a pandemic treaty actually goes ahead. So there's been a number of proposals being put forward that we should look at developing a new treaty to respond to pandemics better in the future. And we've seen that recommendation come from a number of different commissions as well as reviews of the pandemic response. But ultimately, the decision or the jury is still out on whether or not governments feel that a pandemic treaty is warranted. So there's a meeting which is about to start to discuss this very topic and then trying to consider what comes next.
Okay, now we're going to get back to that meeting and to what, if anything, it might agree to change. But before we do that, we thought it would be good to get a sense first of how the system we have in place already actually works.
So we actually have an existing international framework called the International Health Regulations. They were originally adopted in 1951, and then they've been significantly revised, most recently in 2005. And the IHR was the framework that member states were operating, that governments were operating under in the event that we had sort of some sort of disease outbreak that started to spread internationally. And people have questioned, so what aspects of that particular framework need to be strengthened or changed? And some governments are saying rather than going down the road of negotiating a whole new international instrument, we would be better served to focus our attention on revising and updating or fixing the international health regulations.
Yeah. And in the case of the COVID-19 pandemic, I mean, I guess, are there some obvious failings when we look back at the way COVID began in China, but then spread very rapidly to places like South Korea, Iran, Italy? Could we have done something different?
Well, one of the questions that has arisen, obviously, is why the WHO didn't declare a pandemic earlier. And the WHO, you might recall, back in March of 2020 was actually saying, well, technically, we don't have the legal authority to declare a pandemic. Under the international health regulations, the largest alert they can declare is what's described as a public health emergency of international concern, or it's pronounced fake for short, which has an unfortunate connotation in an era of fake news. But That is technically what the WHO had the ability to do under the existing international agreements. And of course, they did that on the 30th of January, but governments didn't really react to that declaration by putting in place public health measures. It wasn't until this word pandemic was dropped on the 11th of March that governments really around the world started to pay much more attention and start to implement measures. So that's one of the initial sort of questions is like with a pandemic treaty, are there sort of new powers that would be granted to WHO, including the ability to declare a pandemic under international law?
The World Health Organization has now confirmed what many epidemiologists have been saying for weeks. The coronavirus is a pandemic. There are now more than 120,000 known cases in 114 countries. But it's not the word pandemic we should focus on, says the WHO. It's preparation, public health, and political leadership.
Right. And you mentioned before there is this sort of debate about whether we, you know, reinvent the wheel or use the architecture that we've got and potentially make some changes. Who are the parties at that meeting that you mentioned? And is that the first debate that they're going to have?
So there's actually going to be a special session of the World Health Assembly, and this is only the second time this has ever happened in the history of WHO. The first time it happened was when the Director General, Jong-Wok Lee, unexpectedly died in office, and so they convened effectively an emergency meeting of the World Health Assembly to then elect a new Director General. This is the second time now that this special session will be occurring. And basically it is open to all governments all around the world. So there have been some very strong public statements coming out from some governments. So we've seen the EU in particular, they have been a very strong supporter of the proposal of a pandemic treaty. On the other side, we've had, for instance, the United States, which has sort of suggested maybe a treaty needs to be discussed further down the track.
Right, so this meeting, it's taking place virtually, by the way, is happening because some governments around the world are keen for a new pandemic treaty and others aren't but are going along anyway. And there's a report they're going to consider that was put together by an outfit called the Member States Working Group on WHO Preparedness and Response to World Health Emergencies. But if you imagine that after considering the report, all these countries attending would just agree to the terms of a new treaty there and then, think again.
One of the big proposals at the moment, which one of the recommendations that the working group has suggested, is that member states agree to creating an international negotiating body, or INB for short, to then start to progress the discussions around what a pandemic treaty should look like, as well as what should be included in it, because there are a number of different suggestions for what needs to be addressed by the treaty. So after that, sort of, if that proposal is agreed, if that recommendation is agreed, then after that, what we will expect to see is another series of meetings that start to emerge, where governments will start to work on what's described as a zero draft. So what, before sort of formal intergovernmental negotiations, they'll try and develop a draft version of a treaty so that they can all then start to negotiate over. So that's called the zero draft. We don't have any sort of timeline at this point in time. Some of the recommendations coming from groups like the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response that was coordinated by Helen Clark and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf have suggested that we should see a pandemic treaty adopted within 6 months.
We describe the system as like an analog one in a digital age, which is not to say there isn't big data that's picking up and crunching what's happening. But to go from that through the systems to get to a declaration, it's almost like water torture. It is too slow, not fit for purpose.
But we don't actually have a time frame for how long this might take. And a lot of it will depend on how contentious some of those issues are going to be.
And the issue of access to vaccines worldwide is also something that a hypothetical treaty would cover. How might that work?
This is one of the probably biggest issues which is going to be discussed, because you can imagine from many countries in the world, particularly the world's poorest, that haven't yet had access to the vaccines. When we're talking about, well, let's have a treaty, a new treaty, their position is, well, unless we address this question of vaccine access and equity, we're not even interested in starting discussions about a treaty. So this is it's got to be on the table. But of course, from a high income country perspective or a wealthy country, if you have vaccine manufacturing capacity, leaders in those countries have understandably wanted to try and vaccinate their own populations ahead of anybody else. And so whether or not we're going to see governments willing to negotiate some of that protection away to sort of have a more equitable basis of distribution is going to be a really big challenge to try and negotiate. And whether or not, and of course, for those countries that don't have access to those vaccines, their position is very likely to be very clear around the idea that, well, if you're not willing to discuss it, we're not even going to come to the table.
And the governments of some developing countries are coming into this meeting with quite a bit of anger about that issue, by the sounds.
Absolutely, because, you know, I think even the latest statistics show that less than 5% of the world's poorest countries have yet had their first dose, let alone a second or third. That's happening in many high-income countries around the world. So for them, they're like, well, our people are, you know, 2 years into the pandemic, our people still don't have access to these vaccines. And so you can understand a level of anger and frustration coming from those governments as to why this is going to be front and center of any sort of discussions about a new treaty. Whereas for many high-income countries that have already vaccinated their populations and are now putting third boosters into people's arms, their position is somewhat, well, it's an issue, but, you know, we've protected our people, so it's not a, you know, for them, they're in a position of safety and security, I guess, going into the discussions about that particular topic.
You did make a reference to it before, but I'm just curious on this point. What do we know about the different positions around the world? There's a difference potentially between the European position and the American position, for example.
Yeah, so the American position is really, look, we've got something already. Let's try and revise and update that, fix it. If there's gaps then we sort of look at another instrument. Whereas the European Union has been really quite forward-leaning on the idea of a whole new treaty. And so they're really pushing for that. And they've got support from a number of other countries around the world that also see that it's an important step. And so there's even a group which have described themselves as the friends of the pandemic treaty amongst governments. So it's been quite interesting to sort of see the politics start to sort of already emerge before the meeting actually happens of this special World Health Assembly.
And what about China?
Well, I think China is probably one of the countries that everyone is still sort of got a big question mark over as to whether or not they're going to support. They haven't come out like the EU and the US sort of making these sorts of statements. And so how some of the other big countries like Russia, even Brazil, where they stand on the proposal for a pandemic treaty, they haven't really been public about it. So we don't really know how they're going to react.
And just from your perspective, how important do you think getting a pandemic treaty up is? Or do you have some time for the American position, which is potentially building up what we've already got is a better place to start?
I guess my position on this is one of pragmatism. There are conceivably some advantages of a treaty, but fundamentally, when we talk about the weaknesses of the response with the COVID pandemic and why things didn't happen particularly fast on various different issues, and we can use the example of why governments didn't react to the WHO's declaration of a public health emergency of international concern. That's fundamentally because member states designed the instrument previously. And one of the big criticisms of the IHR has been that it doesn't actually have any teeth. So if governments do the wrong thing, there's no consequences for it. Now, of course, the reason why it doesn't have any teeth or consequences is because governments weren't willing back in 2005 to allow for there to be consequences or teeth. So the idea that just simply that by us getting together and talking about or negotiating a new pandemic treaty, that it's going to inevitably lead to a better outcome for everyone, is a little bit of a misnomer, because fundamentally it will be dependent on what governments agree. And I think this is where internationally, the people of the world also have a voice. So if we are saying to our governments, we weren't happy with how the pandemic has been responded and we want to see something different, then arguably there's a need for that to be conveyed to our leaders and the negotiators ultimately that are going to be in a room talking about what new instrument is going to be adopted and developed. So, again, there's conceivably a long way to go around this. A treaty could be helpful, but it could actually be a waste of time, even the negotiations potentially. So it just depends on what governments will agree to compromise on.
Yeah, and you can just imagine quite easily why consequences and teeth is something that states are not that excited to sign up for. But just hypothetically, if we were to progress to that stage, what sorts of consequences and teeth might come into the treaty?
Well, so this is one of the big proposals, obviously, which even was sort of put forward by our own Prime Minister, was that the World Health Organization should have the authority to be able to go into countries and do an investigation to identify sort of what's happened and how a new disease has emerged.
Australia will continue to, of course, pursue what is a very reasonable and sensible course of action, that the world would want to have an independent assessment of how this all occurred so we can learn the lessons and prevent it from happening again.
So that has been a proposal that a number of other governments have actually sort of agreed with. They think that, you know, we need to give the WHO more authority. But of course, it's always the case of like, but what if the shoe is on the other foot and if it's your country which is being investigated? And that's one of the tricky issues then, because governments go, oh, well, no, we would be fine. You know, we don't need WHO coming into our country to do an investigation about what we've done because we're all good. And of course, that is replicated across 194 member states. So how we actually sort of get to an agreement around that is going to be one of the tricky parts. And what happens then if member states disagree? Or they decline to let a WHO team into their country to do an investigation? What are the consequences and what are the issues that other member states then are willing to see happen? There's actually very little in practical terms conceivably that can be done other than things like preventing a member state from voting on issues in the World Health Assembly or other sorts of matters, procedural matters like that, at the moment, at least anyway, within our existing sort of arrangements. So it just depends, again, really what member states are going to be prepared to accept during those negotiations or discussions. And if we end up with a better system than what we've got, then conceivably it's been a worthwhile exercise. If we end up with pretty much the same sort of sets of arrangements where there's no consequences if governments do the wrong thing, whether or not that has actually been a useful use of everyone's time is the big question.
That's The Signal for today. Our email is thesignal@abc.net.au, and we'll be back here in your feed at the same time tomorrow. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.